What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. This is our first show of 2025, and we are so excited to be here with you. And we have a really exciting show for you today. We have two great guests because we want to make sure that we kick off the year right. And what better way to do that than with two excellent writers, journalists who are going to talk about two different but related things. And you'll, I think, see the connection shortly. But before we bring on our first guest, who is the legendary reporter, Bob Scheer, I just want to remind people to please give this stream a thumbs up. That's an easy way to support this show for free. Also, if you can, please become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. And if you join at the $1 a month level, of course, we appreciate that. That helps the show happen. We literally couldn't do the show without that support. But if you want extra content, like extended interviews, like, for instance, we have a very long, I think, hour-long interview with Tony Greenstein that people have really been enjoying. And he, of course, is the author of this, Zionism During the Holocaust, The Weaponization of Memory in the Service of State and Nation. So we released a big chunk of that interview, but patrons at the $5 level get that full interview. And that's at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Please subscribe. We're almost at, how many subscribers do we have? We're at 244,000. We got to get to 250,000. So if you haven't already subscribed, please hit subscribe and then the bell. I think that those are the only announcements that we want to make. And so during the second half of the show, we're going to be speaking to the extremely smart, interesting Mo Tachik, who has written and done really good investigative reporting about healthcare. She's going to be talking to us about Luigi Mangione. But during the first half of the show, we are speaking to the inimitable Bob Scheer, Robert Scheer, who is the publisher of Scheer Post. He has written 8 books, including 2 this decade, Great American Stick Up, How Reagan Republicans and Clinton Democrats Enriched Wall Street While Mugging Main Street. His newest book is They Know Everything About You, How Data Collecting Corporations and Snooping Government Agencies Are Destroying Democracy. He is a clinical professor of communications at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California. He has interviewed Jimmy Carter, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and others. And between 1964 and 1969, he was Vietnam correspondent, managing editor, and editor-in-chief of Ramparts magazine. So welcome, Bob.
How are you doing?
Good, you?
All right. The world is not doing as well, but let's talk about it.
That is true, right? That's something that has not changed since last year, sadly, since 2024. And we're actually going to get to that because we're going to be talking about foreign policy. But the reason I was really excited to have you on, and I kind of thought immediately, oh, I have to have Bob Scheer on, is because, of course, as people know, Jimmy Carter has died. And you did a legendary interview, iconic interview with Jimmy Carter in 1976. In fact, let's take a look at the cover. We have the cover of the magazine, and that magazine was Playboy. We can talk about why it was at Playboy in a second, but here's the Carter Playboy edition. We also have a photo of you with Carter. So tell us about how this interview happened in the first place.
Well, you know, we have this idea that somehow media was great before the internet came along. And it was an irresponsible rat race, basically at the service of people running huge corporations, media corporations, Time Life, the LA Times that I ended up working for right after the Carter interview, the New York Times. And they all were scrambling against television that was on the rise for market, for readers, for eyeballs, and so forth. And, you know, there's an old saying, never hustle a hustler. And a lot of what you did as journalism was to approach people. You know, Time needs a scoop for this week. Newsweek needs one. You gave Time last week. Or who's going to get the... In every area of journalism, I did stuff for, you know, all kinds of magazines, Esquire and, you know, others. They... So this was in that atmosphere. I was doing a lot of writing then, and among other things, I was doing Playboy interviews, and Playboy had 20 million readers or viewers, whatever they were looking at. But the Playboy interview was very famous. A lot of very respectable people did the Playboy interview, and you know, whether it was cover for the sex or not, it had attained that level of seriousness. And I had done already Jerry Brown, who was running in that particular campaign. I did other people. And when I talked to I started out just writing about Jimmy, but then I talked to him about, you know, doing the interview. We were still in the primary season, you know, and it was not for sure that this Southern governor, Georgia governor, whose family actually had been associated with kind of racist South up to that point. But, you know, he'd gone off to Annapolis and became a more modern person, that this was going to be a good leader for the Democratic Party. It was a real issue. And he was also wearing religion on his sleeve. And this is when most of born-again Christians, being poorer in the South and everything, were still Democrats. After all, the South had been the center of segregation. Lyndon Johnson broke that pattern as president, but you know, it was still there very deeply. Carter's family was the most prominent family in his home area. They had certainly supported segregation. Carter himself as governor had started out pretty conservative and yet now was seen as a more modern liberal person. And as I say, he'd gone off and studied physics in Annapolis and gone into the Navy and all that. But nonetheless, it was a very hot issue still in the South and in Plains where he was. And so the concern was, you know, as I say, never hustle a hustler. They were using Playboy, the people around Carter, to show he's really not, you know, an uptight Southern white Baptist. He can be very modern and so forth. And so we started these interviews and they got really interesting. And I always had this idea as a journalist, keep your listening ears open, something you tell children. And, you know, so I found the discussions very interesting because I found Carter to be, as almost everyone I ever talked to in life, more complex than they projected. And he certainly was, and he had understood all of the contradictions that he was involved with. So we were doing these interviews, and the way you do it when somebody's, as he increasingly became the front runner, there's a lot of people want time with this guy. You know, I had the same experience with Ronald Reagan. I did him for the LA Times and then profiled him for Playboy and others. But you're competing with everybody for time as the guy gets more popular. And so what we ran into was, so we had very good, candid discussion, which got put together as the Playboy interview, but they were conducted over a 4-month period, as I also covered the campaign and wrote about it and so forth. And what happened was he was successful. And the Playboy had a lead time of like 3 months or something. And this thing had taken so long. Sometimes I get a half hour, sometimes I get 20 minutes. And, you know, we go like this. And meanwhile, I was learning a lot about Jimmy Carter, about the South, about the Democratic Party in the South. And boom, there we are in New York, the Democratic Convention, and he's suddenly the candidate. Well, that changed the whole ballgame. They didn't really need Playboy anymore. In fact, it was a potential embarrassment. Why'd you give an interview to Playboy, you know? And he was thinking, and his people, the primary. Nonetheless, I had been promised one last interview now that he was the candidate. And they were now concerned, what is in this interview and so forth, you know? And so I made an appointment. They invited me to come to Plains right after he took the nomination in New York at the convention, which I attended. And I was down in Plains. I first went to Atlanta. I had dinner with Jody Powell, his press secretary. We talked about what was wrong. And I was honest about it. I said, look, if the goal here was to show that he's not uptight about religion, I think certainly for Playboy readers, there'll be a concern. After all, you're up against what remained of the 1960s, and do we need this guy? But also, my Playboy interview, if anybody reads it, and they should, it really was a lot about what kind of Democrat are you going to be? Are you going to be a Cold War Democrat like Lyndon Johnson, who got us into Vietnam and this nightmare world, or as well as social issues, personal freedom, and so forth? And so I told Jody that I think what was really missing is that, you know, he didn't really answer some of these questions. So went down to Plains with my Playboy editor, Barry Golson, a great guy, and who was very helpful in all this. And we talked to him. And at the end of the interview, and if you see the pictures, I was always very insecure. Am I doing a good recording? Because a lot of it is done on airplanes. So you can see he had about 4 microphones on him, and I'm sitting there with him, so there's no question, but it was at the end, and this was the scene in his home in Plains. And, you know, at the very end, we were outside, and leaving, and he said, well, is that it? And he had in mind something from Jody, what he was supposed to say. And so he said what was really a very reasonable statement. He's explaining, you know, he's a Sunday school teacher, and he was explaining, as he had been doing all along, that he's an ordinary person, that he has the same desires that other people have, and it's a struggle with the devil, right? That's what the religion is all about. Right. You defeat the devil inside you and become purer so that you can go to heaven and be rewarded. And what he gave was really a pretty standard Sunday school answer, you know, a statement, look, I'm not a freak here. I understand we're struggling with human desires. And yes, I've lusted in my heart, you know. And
the famous quote, yeah.
You know, it got, okay. I thought the controversy in the interview was going to be something else he had said, and we had explored in great detail, which is how do you relate to power in America, you know, the condition of ordinary people, but mainly a lot of it was on war, the war economy, the Vietnam War, which we've gone through, and the Democratic Party being as much a war party as we had. After all, Dwight Eisenhower, the great war hero, had been open to negotiation with Russia. Richard Nixon, who started life as a strong anti-communist cold warrior, made the opening to China, did this incredible thing. We can live with the Chinese communists. That Richard Nixon, you know, and here the Democrats were still given to a Cold War mentality. It was there they could defend their liberalism. They were liberal cold warriors, so you couldn't call them lefties, you know, and they could appeal to jingoistic Americans, and they're going to certainly give you a big military budget, and they're more patriotic than anyone. That was a card the Democrats have continued to play. Look at Joe Biden. You know, you have Donald Trump, who was supposed to be the worst monster we're all supposed to be afraid of. And yet Donald Trump actually didn't start any wars. I'm not going to defend Donald Trump here, but Joe Biden can't fund enough wars. So one of the big surprises that we're in a situation politically right now that Jimmy Carter thought would never happen again. You know, he thought we're going to learn the lessons of the Cold War. So when I asked him, what kind of Democrat are you? Because he's, you know, he was in the military, he was in the Navy, and he gave very thoughtful answers. And he said, I wouldn't do another Vietnam. And I said, well, why? The Democrats have always said, you know, they're not going to be more mongers, but they are. And he said, because I would never lie to the American people the way Lyndon Johnson did. Now, that is an incredible statement for a candidate for president, and certainly one now who's just been had been nominated. But he said this before he got the actual nomination. It was in the interview. It was, you know, we're all set to run this thing. I just was getting the last thing. I thought that was going to be the explosive thing. And in fact, when the interview came out, I was on Carter's plane. And there was a bigger press plane that also flew in. But we're coming back on one of our trips. This was after the planes thing, but before the interview came out. When the interview came out, I was on the plane. So, and there was a buzz in, among the press in the back of the plane. Carter was in the front of it. And there was a buzz, the Playboy. I knew it was coming out, but I didn't know it was coming out that hour. And the plane lands. Lady Bird Johnson, Lyndon Johnson's, is waiting at the airport where we land in Texas, and she's supposed to campaign for him. And the interview comes out, and so I get off the plane. I got my bags and everything, and Sam Donaldson is there with his TV crew from ABC, I guess. And Bob, you got to come over here. I got to put you on the air now, you know. So I said, well, wait a minute. Do I have a tie? What? Okay, yeah. So Sam Donaldson gets me in front of his set, and he said, Bob, this is the guy who did the Playboy interview, you know. And so he doesn't ask me about Lust and Heart because they hadn't read down through it. And we didn't hype that as the big, despite being Playboy. And he said, and his first question was about Lynn calling LBJ a liar. LBJ was right. Dead, you know, so, you know, and, he, you know, here's the Democratic candidate. And he said, I would never lie to the way to American people, the way LBJ did. And it was not a got you moment. Like he said it, you know, when you're catching somebody on the run, this was a considered observation in an interview. And by the way, he never disclaimed it or anything. And the fact is he lied a great deal about foreign policy as president, getting us all involved in Afghanistan. And then that's what did it. What, it destroyed his administration, the whole problem with Iran and so forth, and the hostage crisis and all that. He immersed us in this whole involvement with the Muslim world. Remember this? And it was interesting in the interview, in the article I wrote with it, Hamilton Jordan, who was his political operator, and he's a really good guy. I liked him. I liked them all. Actually, I liked Jimmy too, by the way. I thought he was a great guy. But Hamilton Jordan, though, all the people around him, when I talked to him and I wrote my article, they said, no, we're not going to be like these Cold War Democrats. You know, that was crazy. Vietnam was crazy. And Hamilton Jordan even made the flat out statement. He said, he's consulting with all these hawks, and he is kind of a hawk. And Hamilton Jordan said, it became a famous quote for a while. He said, look, if we get in power and you and Jimmy appoints, you see somebody like Zbigniew Brzezinski in the government, you know, as Brzezinski was the big hawk as opposed to Cy Vance, who was more interested in negotiation. He said, I don't oppose Carter. That's not going to happen, you know. And sure enough, he gets in to be president. And the person who takes over is Zbigniew Brzezinski, who ironically is somebody I know, knew, had profiled for the LA Times back in at that time. And so I knew him. But
Bob, let me just explain to people who don't know. This is great.
The media reacted to the Lust thing. I overwhelmed everything. But
right. And I want to, for people who don't know, because not everyone was around for that article, here's what was said in the article. And again, for context, this is, you know, Carter, he's trying to show he's a normal guy and not too uptight, right? And so he said, I try not to commit a deliberate sin. I recognize that I'm going to do it anyhow because I'm human and I'm tempted. And Christ set some almost impossible standards for us. Christ said, quote, I tell you that anyone who looks on a woman with lust has in his heart already committed adultery, end quote. I've looked on a lot of women with lust. I've committed adultery in my heart many times. This is something that God recognizes I will do, and I have done it, and God forgives me for it. But that doesn't mean that I condemn someone who not only looks on a woman with lust, but who leaves his wife and shacks up with somebody out of wedlock. Christ says, don't consider yourself better than someone else because one guy screws a whole bunch of women while the other guy is loyal to his wife. So that is kind of a shocking thing from him.
Maybe not, you shouldn't use the word screw, but that's
what he said. I didn't say that. Okay.
I know.
Okay.
But
obviously you were there.
I know you're a very proper young lady. Yes. But the point is that it's in the manner of Sunday school teaching that you've confessed to being human. We all have human desires. We all are competing for our soul with the devil and virtue on different sides and so forth. And for some, and I've been told this, by the way, I had many discussions with Carter I had three or four discussions with Carter. He first of all wrote a book about his religion in which he tried to disown a bit the interview and, I didn't know the tape recorder was on or something. And then he apologized. I have a letter from Carter. By the way, all of this is in a very good book called Playing President. That is a collection of my interviews.
By Robert Scheer.
I interviewed Bill Clinton. I interviewed Ronald Reagan. I had a lot of experience interviewing. I interviewed Richard Nixon after he was in office. I spent more time, at least Reagan kept telling me, I spent more time with him than any other reporter. I interviewed him before he was governor. I interviewed him before he was president. And I always took it very seriously that I'm there interviewing. This is not the profile piece. There was a piece I wrote in Playboy where I gave you my view, what I learned from it, and so forth. But this was always done in a meticulous way. And I must say, I want to praise Playboy for this and what it was, what Playboy was. And I want to give Barry Golson a lot of credit, the guy who was my editor there, because Playboy put a standard of integrity on that interview that I didn't find elsewhere in journalism to that degree. I never found it. Kretschmer was the overall editor. There were other great people that had been connected. But working with Barry Golson, no one ever asked me, I can tell you, because I did Jerry Brown for them, and there were questions about Jerry Brown and his love life and everything. And I said, look, I'm not going there. I'm not interested in it. And they said, enough. They never asked me to ask Jimmy Carter about sex. They never did. That was all my pushing. What does it mean to be a fundamentalist Christian? And when you're going to become president of the United States, a legitimate line of questioning. Yeah. But there was no interest at all in Playboy. They were very happy. It sold more copies than any Playboy had sold or something. So that was good. But no one, and Barry Golson in particular, he had been the editor of the Yale Daily News or something. He had been at Atlas Magazine. He had a serious journalistic background. He knows, a whole bunch of languages. Very smart fellow. But nobody at Playboy ever told me I'm supposed to ask. I was asking about the role of religion. I was asking, what does it mean to be a born-again Christian?
Morality. It's a great interview. I highly recommend it. Yeah, and you do wrestle with these questions. And he's a little...
Jonathan Alter wrote a very long, huge book on Carter. And he does say in there, he thinks that's the best political interview or the article where there was the best political article. And his book is very thorough, very good book. But I want to say that it got cheapened because people wanted to use it as a gotcha thing to attack Jimmy Carter. So it's just the irresponsibility of the mass media in the pre-internet glorified age that got it all screwed up, and then they suddenly forgot what he said about foreign policy. Look, let me give you one big...
I want to show you one of the questions you asked, okay? Because we have a... So I want to go to that question that you refer to. So you write, how do you respond to the argument that it was the Democrats, not the Republicans, who got us into Vietnam?
I just want to tell you, my wife just held up a sign, said, let her talk.
Okay.
So I want to give a full-throated apology at this point.
Oh, don't worry. That's okay. And thank you, Narda, for that. Yes. and Narda is, we've had Narda on the show, who is a wonderful journalist. And
my
wrote,
boss at the LA Times.
Your boss. My boss. Yes. Yeah. And also wrote that great book. We had her on with Pat Tillman's mom to talk about that great book that they wrote together, Boots on the Ground.
Boots on the Ground, about the killing of Pat Tillman. Yeah.
About Pat Tillman, yeah. So it's high nerder. Playboy, how do you respond to the Playboy is you, obviously. How do you respond to the argument that it was the Democrats, not the Republicans, who got us into the Vietnam War? Carter, I think it started originally maybe with Eisenhower, then Kennedy, Johnson, then Nixon. It's not a partisan manner. I think Eisenhower probably got us in there thinking that since France had failed, our country might slip in there and succeed. Kennedy thought he would escalate involvement by going beyond the mere advisory role. I guess if there was one president who made the most determined effort conceivably to end the war by massive force, it was certainly Johnson. And Nixon went into Cambodia and bombed it and so forth. It's not partisan. It's just a matter that evolved as a habit over several administrations. There's a governmental consciousness to deal in secrecy, to exclude the American people, to mislead them with false statements, and sometimes outright lies. Had the American people been told the facts from the beginning by Eisenhower? And then there's more, but that's all we'll play for right now.
The more is we would have never gone in. And then I said, but isn't it in the logic of politics that you will? Because in fact, the real issue was, is this guy, it's the same issue with Trump, same issue with Bernie Sanders or Biden. Are these guys for real when they tell us they feel our pain and they want to help us? And they want to make America great again or improve the economy or so forth? Or are they just throwing out words are they going to do what they think our political, economic power elite and establishment want them to do? And Jimmy Carter, like Donald Trump, amazingly, Donald Trump, this super rich hustling guy, nonetheless, we're coming on as populists. Right. And it's the misuse of what was an honorable tradition of populism, speaking for the people and challenging power. And then during campaigns, they all pretend to feel our pain and care a lot about us. And they end up making life not only miserable for us, but for the rest of the world. And that's, you know, it's a sick, manipulative game that's played in the name of democracy. It makes a mockery of democracy. That's really what you're talking about. And this is a very good exhibit, a great example of that destruction of democracy by PR, by garbage, you know, by manipulating images. Let me give you one very good example here. And that has to do with the condition of Black people in America. Jim Carter, you know, this whole reinvention of the South and the New South and everything as if, you know, oh, slavery was just some accident and segregation and so forth. And when I went down there, and that's what the piece, which, by the way, I put up on SharePost as well, but you can also refer to that, that ran with the Playboy piece. I had been in Plains in 1960. I had gone through there, and I was with some people who are braver than I was that actually wanted to integrate bathrooms. And I also had a lot of dealing with the civil rights movement. And so when I got to involve with Carter, I remembered I had been in this movie set of a hometown that he had, Plains. It was great for TV. It was great for Tell Hill, Peanut Farmer, and so forth. Well, it also was one of the most viciously segregated, hostile, murderous parts of the South. And Jimmy Carter came from the wealthiest family in that county. And he had played footsie with segregationists and so forth. You know, he was there was a pass to deal with. What kind of liberal are you going to be? And by that point, he had changed his tune. That was why he wanted to do the Playboy interview, to show I'm not a Southern conservative, which was still, remember, the Democratic Party was based in segregation and slavery. And that's the thing. They like to reinvent. Somehow it's the Republicans, but it was the Southern
Dixiecrats, right?
Yeah, it was solidly Democratic. And he was supposed to be a new Democrat. Okay. Right. And so I was asking him a lot of questions. And now it's interesting. If people go back into that interview, but also the article I wrote with it, I had been there. There were brave people in the South, even before Martin Luther King, by the way, who served. It was jailed in Americus, the big town, really, the real town near Plains. But when I was there, I went to a place called Koyaneer Farm, which was people, again, with Christianity. They had come out with their Christian conscience, had decided segregation was against God's will. And they had formed a farm there in which black and white people worked together and tilled the land and issue a statement of equality. And ironically, Hamilton Jordan, the manager of Carter's campaign, it was his uncle Clarence and his aunt Florence who had this wonderful integrated farm that was being shot at. Occasionally, you know, the people try to burn it down. So the racists in that area. And I knew about that farm because I had read about in the Nation magazine, the longest magazine. Let me pay tribute to the Nation. Great history, the longest continuously publishing political magazine in America. But as a kid going to school in the Bronx, I would read the Nation. I loved the Nation. And in there, they would have advertisements to help this place called Koyaneer Farm buy their hams or their peanuts or whatever, send them money because they're being choked and smothered and endangered and shot at by these racists up the road from Jimmy Carter, you know. And so when I went to interview him, I said, geez, I know this place. I was here 16 years ago. And I stayed in that house when there was actually an incident of shooting. I met with these people, you know, and so forth. And so that became the substance of my story. And then a fellow graduate at Annapolis Singletary was a great hero. He had signed up with them. There were people in Plains who had come out against segregation way before the Democratic Party did. Right. This was in 1960. And some people in Carter's family, Billy, who was described routinely as some kind of segregationist racist, wasn't at all. He shucked the peanuts. I talked to Billy about it. He has stuck his neck out and shucked their peanuts when the others were boycotting. So they couldn't, you know, sell their peanuts. And Billy was one of the heroes of my piece. I thought he got a bad rep. And
sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but you have so many amazing
my wife
stories.
Said I should shut up. So let
me
do
it's it, not that I want to shut you off. I just want to make sure we get to certain really important things. I'm going to have to do like a marathon interview with you though at some point soon. I'll come visit you and we'll do it. Yeah. It won't be live though.
You got to watch it. I'm 88 now. You got to do it before I die.
Yeah, right, I'll come. Well, we'll do it this year then. I'll visit you. Yeah. But I just want to finish because I didn't finish that quote. So what was said in that quote that got unfortunately cut off, and apologies for that, because it was relevant, not irrelevant part, was that after you said, had the American people been told the facts from the beginning by Eisenhower, Kennedy, McNamara, Johnson, Kissinger, Nixon, I think there would have been different decisions made in our government. So there he is basically calling all of these people liars. And as you said, that wasn't as newsworthy as him saying that he had lust in his heart. But I want to show something else that you said, another part of this interview. So you wrote, then would you summarize your position on foreign intervention? And Carter says, I would never intervene for the purpose of overthrowing a government. If enough were at stake for our national interest, I would use the prestige, legitimate diplomatic leverage, trade mechanisms, but it would be the sort of effort that would not be embarrassing to this nation if revealed completely. I don't ever want to do anything as president that would be a contravention of the moral and ethical standards that I would exemplify in my own life as an individual, or that would violate the principles or character of the American people. So how honest was that assessment?
Well, he may have intended that, but he had already abandoned it in terms of where he was getting his vice. His principal advisor was Zbigniew Brzezinski, who, by the way, personally I liked, and my own son, young at the time, went hiking with Zbigniew in Maine with his family. And so
Was Mika there? Mika, his daughter?
Well, it's one of the things that happens as a journalist. You end up socializing with people right. you write about, hopefully you can still keep your objectivity and,
you know,
and sometimes anger them. So later when I went to work at the LA Times, Zbigniew Brzezinski called Otis Chandler, our publisher, and was yelling at him that he should fire me because I did a profile of him. So, you know, I'm not saying friendship only goes so far, but I was able to get along with him. But there was no question, this guy was the ultimate hawk. And, you know, he come from this Polish family that obviously had a terrible experience with the Soviet Union. And so he was the ultimate hawk. And he certainly did not want to wind down the Cold War, which Nixon clearly wanted to do, because clearly Nixon understood communism was not international, it was nationalist. The Chinese communists and the Russian communists were shooting at each other across the border occasionally. We were in Vietnam to stop communism. We lost our most ignominious defeat in Vietnam. And what happened? Vietnam and China went to war. They didn't invade us in San Diego. The two communist governments went to war. And by the way, the U.S. government right now would like Apple to be assembled its iPhones in communist Vietnam rather than communist China. So the whole Cold War was utter nonsense. And intelligent people like Jimmy Carter at that point already knew it. But that's Zbigniew Brzezinski. And Zbigniew Brzezinski is on record as having said he gave Russia, the Soviets, their Vietnam by creating a situation. They created a situation in which the Soviets got involved in their war in Afghanistan. And Carter, when he got in there, they certainly were supporting that. And the whole war on terror and everything else, you could place in some ways at Carter's step for all of his image of caring about people, habitat for humanity, all of which is very good as a post-president. As a president, Carter was a Democratic warmonger and created a great dangerous situation, and it was his undoing. Oddly enough, it's his undoing. You know, the very thing he assured me he would never do, they ended up lying like crazy. And this happened. It was also with Iran and the hostage crisis, a total denial of the history of Iran, the U.S. role in creating the Shah, the overthrowing the Mossad. It was all a tissue of lies, like so much of American foreign policy, which Carter personally knew. That much I know. Mm-hmm. He's a smart guy. And I should say, by the way, way after the Playboy interview, I ran into Carter because he wrote that book, Questioning It, and we had an exchange of letters. And I actually had a nice discussion with him at UCLA and other places where he showed up. And so I think at the end, it was quite friendly. But he was very determined as a ex-president to support peace. I mean, he returned to the wisdom right. that he showed in my interview. And so, yes. You know, I'm all for respecting Jimmy Carter overall as an individual, giving him the respect he's due, certainly for his post-president. He's the greatest ex-president we ever had, no right. question about it. I think he was a thoroughly decent person deep down, but I feel the same way about Ronald Reagan, and that gets people angry with me wow. on the other side, you know.
I'm angry with you on the left side for saying that.
Well, but if you keep your listening
ears, you really think
look,
he was decent?
I got along with
Ronald
Nixon.
Reagan?
I was one of the people Nixon tried to destroy. I had my taxes audited. God knows what. I was the editor of Ramparts magazine at one point. I certainly had a lot of trouble and I'd had with Johnson. But the fact of the matter is, you know, it's the issue that's corrupt. It's the power that's corrupting. It's sure. not the individual. This is what's the whole question of Carter was raising about his Christian ethics. He abandoned them. You know, he abandoned them in the face of power and rewards and so forth. And when he didn't have power as ex-president, he could return to it. And the same right, thing happened with Nixon.
But there is something structural, right?
Yeah.
We can talk about this because there's obviously something structural that makes it so that, you know, look at the Obamas. They just hang out with Richard Branson. Look at the Clintons. They do the incredibly corrupt Clinton Foundation. I mean, Carter is, I think what is a fair assessment, right, is that he was a typical president and he was like a space typical president, but he was an atypical former president. And, you know, I want to ask you about why it is, why he was able to do stuff like Habitat for Humanity and other presidents weren't able to do that. But before we go on to that, I do want to talk to you about a piece that your colleague at Sheer Post wrote, Chris Hedges, Don't Deify Jimmy Carter. And one of the things that he talks about with Jimmy Carter is he accuses Jimmy Carter of selling out the Palestinians. And what's so interesting is that Jimmy Carter is justifiably praised for what he said after being president. In fact, first, we're going to take a look at something that you asked him about in an interview. You brought this up. Robert Schrum, one of the many people who's still around, unfortunately. I'm not saying I wish death upon him. I just mean he's not.
Wait. Bob Schrum's a good guy. He's a colleague of mine at USC. These days where I teach and he teaches as well.
Well, that's why I clarified. I'm not wishing him ill. I think he does. Doesn't he do some politically problematic things though?
Sorry.
We'll leave that we can leave that alone. No. But isn't he like a major Dem? Like,
yeah, he's been a political, he worked with Bob. He worked with Teddy Kennedy. In fact,
Bob Schrum,
I think can be credited with writing one of the great speeches, or helping write one of the great speeches. I think he wrote it for Teddy Kennedy that he gave at the Democratic Convention.
When he conceded to Jimmy Carter,
It's one of the best speeches certainly any Democratic politician ever made. And I had great respect for Teddy Kennedy. I thought he was the deal. We shouldn't deal with the corruption of individuals. Like I say, Jody Powell, Hamilton Jordan, Patrick, I'll forget his name already. He was a very important in their campaign. They're all, look, the people around Reagan, the people around Nixon, you know, Haldeman, I was in some kind of hot tub with Haldeman and after Nixon in New Mexico.
I hope he was good at sharing space.
As a journalist, particularly if you've been in mainstream journalism, which I spent a lot of time, I was at the LA Times for 29 years.
You should write a memoir called Hot Tubbing with Haldeman.
Well, I wrote a piece about it, I'm not, you know, the fact is these are human beings. And here Christianity has got it right, by the way. Maybe I sound a little critical of people who take Christianity seriously. But I think the struggle for the soul of people that people have to go through. But it's not an individual struggle exclusively. This is what the mega churches leave out. The society is on the side of the devil most often. It's on the side of power, whatever society. They can call themselves communist. They can call themselves Democrat. They can say they're Islamic. They can say they're Christian. They could be a Jewish state, obviously. I'm Jewish. I'm very deeply ashamed about the Jewish state of Israel is doing
Shonda.
In the name of all Jews. It's a
claiming to do in the name of all Jews, right?
It's a deep tragedy. The point is that we center it on the individual in any society,
and not the structural.
The individual leaders, we're missing the whole point. Corruption comes from power. Corruption comes from the desire for power, rewarding power, celebrating power, the celebrity culture of the United States. Right. That's why. Why is Trump our president for this? So how did he get to be president? Because CBS invented him. The media invented him. I forget his name, the guy.
Who said it was bad for the country, but good for ratings?
Yeah, he said Donald Trump may not be good for America. I don't know if that, but he tells an affiliates meeting, but he's great for CBS. Look at our ratings.
Exactly.
So it's these systems of power called nation states.
The other issue is unless you're corrupt or corruptible or compromised or compromisable, you're not going to get past like state senator or city councilor.
Let me go further. The reason I called my book Playing President, that Akashic published, you could still get it, Playing President. I call it Playing President because I don't think they know which end is up by the time they get to be president. They start reading from scripts. They get filled in. They get briefed. I do a show with Ray McGovern on Post every week. He was with the CIA for 27 years. He briefed, four or five presidents, Ray McGovern, and one of my great heroes in life, by the way, a guy who, you know, came out of the CIA experience and has informed us. But the fact of the matter is, this, you know, they get briefed And then they pick what they want. Yeah, that's true. But they got other advisors saying this is going to offend that group. And this is why was I talking to Carter? Because his sharp political advisors said, you got to reach the Playboy audience, because otherwise right. you're not going to survive the Democratic primary. Not specifically that audience, but left liberal people who were influenced by the 60s. Yeah. So that's why I started with never hustle a hustler. They right. are get where they're going because they're hustlers. And they can tell you anything. They can tell right. you they're going to make America great again. They can tell you, I feel your pain. Look at Hillary Clinton, for guys. Look.
Oh, yeah. I no one believed that she felt anyone's pain. Like, no. as Nina Turner said, Donald Trump lied and pretended he felt people's pain. Bernie Sanders really did feel people's pain. And Hillary Clinton didn't fool anyone. She didn't even pretend to feel people's pain. And neither did Kamala Harris, by the way.
Yeah, but the point is, these individuals only get to that stage of life in a mass media society where money talks. Come on, let's this idea of democracy, it becomes right. absurd when you consider, you know, I'm not going to sing out Elon Musk, but now there's no shame from taking $250 million from somebody. You know, I forget how much the widow of Sheldon Adelson put into the
Miriam.
Yeah, you know, people put in these huge amounts of money and you know, and they know you're not going to get to be president. Now, you know, Bernie Sanders tried to do it without selling right. out. If Bernie Sanders had been willing to sell out, you know, he seems to be constitutionally incapable of it. So I guess he's a lousy politician to represent anyone but Vermont. Maybe they got a lot of
A lot of people would say sold out by endorsing Biden, though.
What? Oh, he sold out.
A lot of people say, right. yeah.
Okay. All right.
But I'm sure, on certain issues. Yeah. I'm just saying. But Bob, I want to make sure that we get to, I have to interrupt a little bit just because, so I'm not even going to read the Schramm because we don't have enough time to get to it. But I do want to bring up the Israel question because let's take a look at what Jimmy Carter said as a post-president about Israel, which is, I think we can agree, impressive. And then I want you to contrast that with how he ruled as president when it comes to the Middle East. So let's take a look at this clip of Jimmy Carter. First, he's speaking on Piers Morgan, and then he's speaking on Democracy Now!
I think more than any other episode or incident or situation on Earth, this is the most directly affecting adversely America in not bringing peace to Israel and justice and peace to the Palestinians, yes.
You obviously were very successful in bringing peace with yes. Israel and Egypt. Can any deal be done that doesn't involve sitting across a table with Hamas?
I've met several times with Hamas leadership, and I think they are willing to accept Israel to exist peacefully within the 67 borders or some modification of those borders. But the first step has to be to bring Hamas and Fatah together so they can have another honest election. That is a major premise. And I think the 67 borders between the two, with some modifications, will lead to a two-state solution. Netanyahu now, I believe, has decided unequivocally to move to a one-state solution, which every one of his predecessors in the prime ministership have condemned as a disaster for Israel. And I think Israel is now moving toward a disaster for itself, and insisting that all the way from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea has to be Israeli controlled. That is a mistake.
And just to clarify, that was from 2012. It's not from right now, obviously. Okay, now let's hear what he has to say on Democracy Now!
Mistake.
The word apartheid is exactly accurate. You know, this is an area that's occupied by two powers. They're now completely separated. The Palestinians can't even ride on the same roads that the Israelis have created or built in Palestinian territory. The Israelis never see a Palestinian except their Israeli soldiers. The Palestinians never see an Israeli except at a distance, except the Israeli soldiers. So within Palestinian territory, they're absolutely and totally separated, much worse than they were in South Africa, by the way. And the other thing is, the other definition of apartheid is one side dominates the other, and the Israelis completely dominate the life of the Palestinian people.
Why don't Americans know what you have seen?
Americans don't want to know. And many Israelis don't want to know what is going on inside Palestine. It's a terrible human rights persecution that is far transcends what any outsider would imagine. And there are powerful political forces in America that prevents any objective analysis of the problem in the Holy Land. I think it's accurate to say that not a single member of Congress with whom I'm familiar would possibly speak out and call for Israel to withdraw to their legal boundaries or to publicize the plight of the Palestinians, or even to call publicly and repeatedly for good faith peace talks. There hadn't been a day of peace talks now in more than 7 years. So this is a taboo subject. And I would say that if any member of Congress did speak out, as I've just described, they would probably not be back into Congress the next term.
So now I'm going to ask you to comment on that, how it compares to his presidency. But I want to say one other thing, which is that at the very beginning, early on in his presidency, he stunned the lobby that he calls out there by saying at a town hall in Clinton, Massachusetts in 1977, he said, there has to be a homeland provided for the Palestinian refugees, which was kind of shocking to say. It shouldn't be, but it was. So what happened between that and the truth-telling he did as post-president and his actual presidency? That was really wonderful. And that was such a great interview. We may have some of that on Patreon, Patreon-only part of that. That's at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. And I always love speaking to Bob Scheer. He is a fascinating person to talk to. So much insight, so much knowledge, so much experience. So we will have him back on shortly for sure. We're going to bring on our next guest, who I'm extremely excited to speak to as well. Mo Tachik is the investigations editor of The American Prospect. Earlier in her career, she worked for The Wall Street Journal, co-founded the feminist site Jezebel, and waited on Steve Miller and Steve Mnuchin's wife at various fine dining establishments. She lives in D.C. with her husband and two sons. So welcome, Mo.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Of course, thanks for joining. So I want to ask you about Luigi Mangione and how his story relates to the reporting that you've been doing on healthcare and also United Health in particular.
Well, United Health is just one of those really diabolical monopolies that no matter what I write about healthcare, and I didn't ever write about healthcare until the pandemic, and I was writing about financialization, private equity, and, you know, stock buybacks and stuff like that. And during the pandemic, I started writing about hospitals and realizing how gutted and busted out the healthcare system really was. And then that, I started looking at United Health because it's the biggest company in healthcare, and it controls so much in so many different, I mean, it is just this kind of, it's called a health insurer, but it's really this kind of ubiquitous middleman. Whether it's controlling, I mean, data and controlling systems, is a huge part of what it does. And, basically, you know, and so that's kind of why I thought it was interesting to write about Luigi. And in fact, obviously he didn't have United Healthcare insurance. He apparently, he's allegedly just fixated on this company. And I think that because it's just such an obvious target. In past, when I've written stories about United Health, I've had I had an old lady, 89 years old. We share a name. She lives in Westchester County, and called me up one day and just wanted to rant about how much she hated her insurance. She's, you know, her husband, she was on an IBM plan and they switched her to a United Health Medicare Advantage plan. And, you know, she did consent to it, but it you know, she didn't really feel, she feels like they tricked her. And, you know, she, this woman hated her insurance so much, and nothing, you know, it hadn't really caused her any injury or, you know, death yet. And she's, you know, 89, but she's a healthy 89-year-old woman, and she basically doesn't count on them for anything. She basically pays for everything out of pocket because she can't handle, you know, all of the waiting on hold that she has to do. And that's just basically how everybody who has that insurance, everybody who deals with United Healthcare, every physician who's involved at all in the reimbursement aspect of the process. So anyone who's like, it's just a widely reviled company. And that's because it's so powerful.
Yeah. And you did a story about a whistleblower who revealed some very disturbing things that happened, basically with surgeons forcing unnecessary procedures on people. And as you note, even admitting to intentionally botching the dissectomy, ultimately causing the patient to require spinal fusion anyways. That was something that he threatened to do. I had spinal fusion surgery. I had scoliosis. Shit. So I had a spinal fusion when I was 11. I'd like to think it was necessary and it wasn't forced on me. I don't think it was. It was interfering with my lungs or it was going to.
Wow.
But can you talk about this this story and this whistleblower?
That's incredible. And I don't think that they, you know, there are a lot of... So... The problem, the reason that I wrote about this, or the reason that I found it so fascinating, is because if you listen to writers in Washington, policy writers, the types of people who write about healthcare, they're wonks, they're kind of like sort of culturally neolib, and they see these sort of problem, they see all of these issues, and the cost of American healthcare is sort of this like a massive like technocratic problem that can be adjusted if you just sort of adjust the incentives. And what they don't recognize, and what I really I didn't fully recognize until I read this book from 1967 called The Plot Against the Patient. And it was written by one of these, you know, a crime writer, a guy who wrote about the mafia, but he also wrote a lot about the organized right. And his name is Fred Cook. And he went, you know, down the rabbit hole of American medicine. And back then, you have to understand 1967, this is really, most of what he was writing about was the pre-Medicare era. But what he recognized was that criminals were all over this industry, and they were whether it was like a, you know, Teamsters, pension funds, you know, basically financing these mafia hospitals where they would get these, you know, sort of crooked surgeons to run up the tab. You know, they saw these Blue Cross, Blue Shield plans that were increasingly being adopted. And they saw them as, you know, the kind of, you know, gravy trains that they were. And there's just... criminals have been attracted to our healthcare system from, you know, sort of the beginning, and they have been very, and probably this probably goes back to, especially during Prohibition, physicians were were bartenders, like in a lot of ways, or they were, you know, that was how they were your access to alcohol, you know, prior to that, you know, they were your access to, you know, narcotics or whatever. So there has always been this kind of like, and there's never been comprehensive or coherent federal regulation of hospitals or healthcare in any way. There's been federal payment structures, but there was never like, even our hospitals are not actually regulated by any federal entity. They're regulated by this sort of private public partnership called the Joint Commission. But anyway, the point is that like, until you realize how many grifters and hucksters and just all out, you know, really evil guys are really have really cornered this sector, you're going to kind of, you know, sort of think that this is like a mathematical issue, or that these are like, you know, that these issues can be solved with policy, when they really need to be solved with like, but they really need to be solved by throwing a lot of guys in prison, you know, and they really need, like, there's consequence that we really need to kind of create consequences for killing patients. And right now, those consequences, you know, after 25 years of tort reform, it's never been more consequence free to just kill a bunch of patients. And it's very profitable. It's a lot more profitable to, you know, neglect the fuck out of them than to actually, you know, treat anyone. So anyway, that having been said, after Luigi Mangione did what he allegedly did, the the "well, actually" crowd, you know, was very quick to step in and be like, we need United Health. We need these health insurers, because otherwise, you know, because doctors make too much money and they're always trying to do unnecessary, you know, that the incentives are misaligned and they're always trying to, you know, run up the tab, and we actually need United Health to be a hedge against that. And that's not necessarily like untrue, but what is true is but what's much more accurate to say is that like maybe 5%, maybe 2 to 5% of physicians are real scumbags, are real, you know, are going to run up the tab.
Not my dad.
No, and there's and most physicians would never even think to do anything, you know, to do harm.
But there are some evil ones. Yeah.
And those are, you know, and those are the heavy hitters. Those are the guys who, and that, and what Medicare did, and then the adoption of, you know, like various healthcare policies like the HMO Act, was really codify and institutionalize the worst practices in healthcare. So basically, you know, you have all these, you know, all these doctors who are either employed by, you know, United Healthcare itself employs 10% of doctors right now in this country. You know, for private equity roll-ups employ another, God knows how, you know, what percentage in emergency medicine it might be, you know, 25-30%, but it's a growing contingent, and most doctors are employed by somebody. Maybe it's a large, you know, monopoly type health system. But physicians these days are sort of like, you know, increasingly disempowered, and so there's a lot of pressure on them to, you know, cut corners, you know, see, you know, 50 patients when, you know, they should really just be seeing 15, you know, you know, call up tests and, you know, order tests and, you know, MRIs that are unnecessary, that kind of thing. But usually they don't do that. And the 5% of physicians who do are the ones who kind of make all the money and get all the glory and, you know, and are sort of untouchable. So what I found was this physician who'd gone to work for United Healthcare thinking, like a lot of, you know, sincere, like I think Ezra Klein and Matt Iglesias might think, that they were going to fight the good fight, that he was going to fight the good fight. And he had seen, you know, a lot of, that he was an orthopedic surgeon, and he'd seen, you know, the damage that, you know, bad surgeons can do. And there was this one particular, physician, this one particular neurosurgeon in Cincinnati, where he was based, called, Tarani, I think they called his, he was known as the butcher of Pakistan, because he was Pakistani, and then he ended up moving back to Lahore. And he had done 600, at least it's 600 unnecessary back surgeries. And he had told, you know, he had preyed on a lot of Medicaid patients. He'd done, you know, he'd worked at a children's hospital, so done a lot of you know, child back surgeries. And he told them things like, you're going to be paralyzed within a month if I don't do the surgery, or your head is going to fall off. Like, Lee literally told that to patients, and ended up botching, like the vast majority of these surgeries on purpose so that he could do more surgeries. And this wasn't the first case like this I'd heard. I mean, I've been working on a story involving a hospital that's hiring a lot of these surgeons who just sort of try to run up the tab this way. And it's really incredible. But this guy, it was the big secret that their hospital had threatened to sue for defamation, to kind of sue the living daylights out of four doctors who tried to blow the whistle on this guy. Nobody, said anything until this one kind of whack job. And this is complicated by the fact that because of tort reform, the non-economic damages in a medical malpractice case are capped in Ohio at $250,000, I believe. And so when you fuck up a kid, you can't say that who's not earning any money, you can't make a lot of money off that. So there are no, you can't really make any money off med mal cases. They're hard to win. And because you can't make any money off them, there's no one really doing med mal anymore. And this is a problem in Texas. It's a problem in a lot of
medical malpractice.
This is a problem in a lot of states. And this is why I say there are really no consequences to killing patients in a lot of states anymore. This one loony lawyer who is a big Trumper, and he blames DEI for half of this, but he took on the cases. He had an 80% success rate. He ended up winning a collective like $300 million in jury awards. And the physician flees to Lahore. The medical malpractice insurer that insured this physician and all the hospitals that he worked in, owned by Warren Buffett, they won't pay a penny to any of these poor patients. Anyway, this physician who went to work for United Healthcare, he had worked on an expert witness on that case, and he had been, he really radicalized by it. He had said, this is a problem. This is the scourge of our community. Maybe we are, too predisposed to trying to, fix problems with surgery, go straight to spinal fusion surgery when something less invasive would work. So he lands on this doctor, and he thinks he's seeing another Tehrani, another butcher of Pakistan. And he sees that he looks through this physician's files, sees that the MRIs, he's misinterpreting MRIs to basically to suggest that patients who have kind of more routine back problems, herniated discs and the like, have what is what Luigi had, which is now I'm blanking on what his affliction was, but it's like spony something. He sees that this physician is deliberately misinterpreting his MRIs. He confronts the guy on the record. He's recording the interview. He confronts the guy in a peer review session, and the doctor says, yeah, so what if I am, like, if you cross me, I'm just going to start like botching these surgeries so that I do have to end up giving the full spinal fusion surgery. Cause the difference is like, it was like $100,000 difference in terms of reimbursement. So this doctor is, totally floored. And he brings this to the ethics panel at United Healthcare. And they're like, I don't know, maybe you need de-escalation training. Like, and essentially, and he never figures out why. And this is never, like, this lawsuit was not, pursued. No, the Justice Department it's a whistleblower lawsuit. And if the Justice Department intervenes in a whistleblower lawsuit, then you can, go undercover, and you can wear a wire and you can kind of get to the bottom of the problems. But the DOJ never intervenes in whistleblower lawsuits, and they ultra never intervene in whistleblower lawsuits against UnitedHealthcare. I've read so many good ones, and this one wasn't even particularly good. It was only like, you know, 7 pages long, but it was because it involved this, spinal fusion surgery, it really kind of, and because it was so unusual, and I got in touch
with
this.
And he was recorded, right? I mean, wasn't the guy being recorded when he said some of those things? The doctor who was threatened to basically mess up on purpose?
He was recorded, and this is all, you know, this is all filed under public record. The physician, when I got in touch with him, he was really, really scared. He was really scared that somebody was going to go after him, whether it would be, you know, his lawyer or the UnitedHealthcare or the physician that he actually blew the whistle on. But it's all, you know, it's all there, in the court documents. And UnitedHealthcare, you know, didn't want to like follow it up. And, you know, we talked about why that was. And he said, you know, basically they didn't want to, you know, go to war at that point. But what it shows me is that, you know, UnitedHealthcare, obviously, they, you know, they're the only figure that we have suggests that they're denying 32-34% of claims. I think that that is on the low side because they control so many physicians through their Optum wing that like employs 10% of the physicians in the country. And those physicians, that doesn't kind of even go through the normal like approval process. They just don't, you know, those claims don't even really get reached to the point where they would be denied. But yeah, so this is a company that like kind of makes its business, denying, legitimate claims. And yet they're willing to kind of let slide this guy who's obviously doing, not only unnecessary, but harmful surgeries, this guy who's clearly harming patients and is on the record saying that, you know, he'll do it again. And that's just the way that things like this seem to work. And I can't tell you exactly why, but like in most cities have a dominant health system or two. Within those health systems, there will be a few surgeons, a few cardiac surgeons, a neurosurgeon, you know, an orthopedic surgeon who are the rainmakers of the hospital and bring in, you know, maybe they bring in like 5% of the hospital's revenue, but they're probably bringing in something like 25% of the, you know, operating income because these are, you know, the high margin facilities, and that's sort of paying for the whole, you know, the rest of everything. All the, you know, the maternity wards are, you know, famously unprofitable, and so, you know, that basically all the OBs will be sort of given the sense that, oh, the, like, you know, the cardiacs, the cath lab upstairs is like paying their salary. And it's this really kind of, you know, those surgeons who are the rainmakers, who do bring in all of the billing in any health system, those are the guys who are the kings. You know, nobody really crosses them. Nobody messes with them. ProPublica just did a really, really like outstanding investigation into this exact dynamic with an oncologist in Helena, Montana. And this oncologist was just killing people. Some of them he was killing quickly. He killed one like 16-year-old girl with like just by, oh, you know, basically plying her with barbiturates until she died. And no one understands why he did that. He killed one of his patients by basically falsely diagnosing him with cancer, and the chemo ultimately killed him. Yet he was on chemo for like 10 years. Nobody really understands why this oncologist was doing it, but he got, you know, 3 CEOs in a row, I think, fired from his hospital because he was such a, you know, he was like the guy who was bringing in all the cash and allowing the enterprise to be profitable. And that's the thing, is that our whole healthcare system, is the viability of it is like built on these guys, you know? And it's you know, when people talk about Medicare for All, it's like, we need it, like the problem is that we need something more extreme than Medicare for All, especially now when, you know, more than half of Medicare eligible patients are on Medicare Advantage plans. We need a national health system. Yeah. And that's also United Healthcare. So that was the thing that, like, you know, I wanted to kind of tell a story that was like as like nuanced as the healthcare system really is, which is like, yeah, United Healthcare does, like, in theory, it would serve an important role in terms of, you know, because not all of the things that a doctor wants to prescribe, not all of the treatments or procedures a doctor wants to prescribe are necessary, are a good idea, right, are good or for healthy, the patient. Yeah. That's absolutely right. True. Our system pays for a lot of, like, you know, that's, I mean, look at the opioid crisis. And again, like, if the opioid crisis, we never had a politician who actually was able to tell the story, like, listen, if you think that profit and healthcare are compatible, you have to think about what just happened for a second. You have to think about the fact that, like, it was the most profitable thing that you can do is get a country addicted to drugs. That is so profitable. Right. Like nothing else. And Purdue Pharma thought about getting into other kinds of drugs. They had McKinsey consultants who were saying, well, you might want to think about diversifying your portfolio in case something happens. And they're like, but the margins. Right. You know, like, I mean, do we really want to, like, you know, we're going to have to invest $10 billion and, you know, and it just didn't, and the math never made sense to them. And so, like, that's the whole thing about healthcare, is that the most profitable healthcare out there is the stuff that nobody needs, you know, it's the unnecessary MRIs, and our whole system is built on that. And it's really sad.
But then at the same time, you do have people being denied. Like, there will be the time where someone needs an MRI and for another reason, they won't be given it.
Exactly. Because that is
the worst of all worlds.
Because, and it's these rainmakers who sort of get the rules don't apply to them. And then everybody else, they're just governed by algorithms. And United Healthcare has, you know, vast, you know, they have the data warehouses full of these algorithms. And basically what all of them do is just provide a pretext for denying care. Yeah. It's so simple. You know, United Healthcare has gotten in trouble with a lot of algorithms, but basically every single time, it's not actually an algorithm. It's just like it's a pretend algorithm. You know, they maybe there was an algorithm when they acquired it, and then they changed it so that, like, you know, basically it's impossible to, you know, the house always wins, right? Like it's kind of just one of those things. So, like, you know, and anything that you actually need, is, and I don't know, you know, again, like the actual machinations of how this works. There's been so many whistleblower lawsuits, you know, you can get into the weeds on how all of it works. But I do have one good piece of news that I just wanted to catch up on. Well, this is just, you know, this is just how America feels about this, because I think that, you know, I, like Luigi, went to Penn. And old. I'm 46 years old. And so my generation does not, you know, a lot of my friends from college, we don't really talk anymore. And a lot of Israel has something to do with that.
Because you're an anti-Semite, Mo.
Yeah. And there's a lot of love for Israel. among Penn alums of a certain age, even though if you listen to what the trustees, it's the most anti-Semitic place that exists.
Right.
But a good friend of mine who we hadn't talked because I had basically asked her what it would take for moderate Zionist women to go against the war. And, but she, you know, she texted me back the other day, you know, as soon as Luigi was, fingered as the man, you know, the assailant, the assassin. And she was just like, man, like, he's, you know, I'd do him. And, you know, it was like one of those things where, you know, if this is a person who, you know, is not, or I don't know, a very moderate Zionist, her husband's a doctor. He actually
left. So you haven't changed her mind on Israel,
but haven't been able to, no. And on healthcare, like she gets it.
Yeah.
And, right. You know, I think that that's just kind of like what people who haven't had interactions with United Healthcare, don't, or the, you know, the mainstream media, like a lot of people don't understand it, but a lot of people do. And so obviously everyone knows that Luigi has raised a lot of money for his defense fund, but Brianna Boston, the poor mom of three,
yes,
she has raised $92,000.
Just for people who don't know, can you just explain what she did?
This poor woman was on the phone with Blue Cross, Blue Shield, which used to be, you know, that used to be a nonprofit, but is now for profit and especially evil. She lives in Florida where healthcare is just like, you know, 85% more evil. Thanks, Rick Scott. And she was on the phone getting, you know, coverage for probably one of her three kids denied. And she said, you know, deny, depose, defend, deny, depose, or something like that. She just,
right, which was on the bullet.
She said,
the case,
you know,
in, right?
Yes, yeah. What Luigi's little, yeah. You know, message. And she said, you know, you guys are going to be next. Like, this is karma. It's going to come for you. Really vague threats, the type of stuff that anybody says. And I, you know, I've been in this position where I'm on the phone with a customer service representative and I'm like, listen, I know that this isn't your fault, but your company's really evil. Right. And like, that's the way that she was talking. She never said anything directly threatening to the customer service representative. I think that she understood. But anyway, she gets turned in for terroristic threats and charged with a felony, and she could be facing 20 years in prison. Her bond was set at $100,000, and her husband, a woman named Miss Lebedieva, I don't know who she was, but a stranger, a kind stranger, set up a legal defense fund for her on GoFundMe, and her husband, after she started raising money, she handed it over to her husband, and her husband like has this nice thank you letter to all her supporters. 2,400 people have donated to poor Brianna Boston's legal defense fund. And I think that, you know, again, like this is just some random woman who definitely didn't want to be Googled for this fact. But the fact is that like everybody has been there. Everybody
right.
has been there. We're there every, you know, if you ever have stood in line, it's CVS buying five people who are like all whose insurance companies are all, you know, denying whatever it is they are, they get, you know, every month. It's like this is like the, you know, one of the most gruesomely unpopular things. And, you know, invariably every time this topic comes up, we are told that, you know, like 60% of Americans are really happy with their health insurance, but it's just like, they're happy that they feel grateful that they have it to begin with and that they haven't had to use it. That's my theory.
Right. Yeah. And plus, I'm very curious about how they're asked that question. Yeah. Because as people know, you know, polling and data, it's presented as if it's these totally quantifiable things. But the results are very different depending on how you're asked a question.
Right. Yeah. I just think it's just, you know, this country is, healthcare is so full of crooks. And and at this point, the doctors have been really, UnitedHealthcare is one of those companies that's really radicalized a lot of the doctors. And they're ready. A lot of them are unionizing. They never thought they'd be union.
Well, Mo, not everyone agrees with you. I wanted to give you the chance to, you actually tweeted this out or you responded to this tweet. We have to be fair and balanced. So let's listen to what Michael Smirkanish had to say of CNN, because he has some feelings about Luigi Mangione and this issue.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/TheKatieHelperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHelperShow. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.